For many of those who align with the left side of the aisle, the Democratic Party has morphed into an unrecognizable husk of itself, pursuing ideas and policies most in line with the cultural winds of the time, while warping the original tenets of the party to very different ends. Some have left the party, yet there remain many within the Democratic Party who still believe in the founding principles and have not broken ties. But the question is why? Here to discuss this with me is Kristen Day, the Executive Director of Democrats for Life of America. Let's jump right in. Kristen, in 2006, you wrote an article for the Notre Dame Journal on Law and Public Policy called Politics and the Culture of Life, Why I Am Still a Democrat. So given that the pro-choice platform of the Democratic Party remains unchanged, and I think it's fair to argue has even become more extreme, I ask the same question here. Why are you still a Democrat?
I believe in the traditional values of what Democrats should stand for, and they have veered away from the focus on protecting the unborn and representing labor. You know, when we see more labor workers voting Republican, Democrats used to be the Labor Party. They're really moving away from what their core values are, and especially on the issue of protecting the vulnerable. And I really feel a duty to stay here and bring the party back to its roots because it's so far moving in the wrong direction to protect people and help people.
So you don't think it's too far gone? I mean, you know, you and I have talked about this previously, but both of my parents were immigrants. They, you know, kind of the traditional big urban immigrant story. They came here. My dad was the Democratic precinct captain, but from Reagan onward, they never voted Democrat, except there was one, I think, candidate in Illinois who was a pro-life Democrat for governor that they did vote for. But other than that, from that point forward, they never voted Democrat again, primarily because of the life issue. And the party just seems to me to have become more and more extreme. So again, I guess I'll rephrase this, but is the horse out of the barn and just so far gone now we'll never get it back?
I believe we will get it back. And the reason is every once in a while I do feel like maybe I should leave, maybe I should give up this fight, maybe I should stop. It's, you know, there's no hope. But then, you know, last night I talked to a candidate who's running in Pennsylvania who is just willing and has the courage to stand up to the party on the issue of life. You know, he wanted to run. They recruited him to run. When they found out he was pro-life, they attacked him. And he said, this is who I am. This is what I stand for. I'm running.
The they being the national party representatives.
His local party. And then people like, you know, Katrina Jackson, Trinae McGee, and these really strong, vocal, courageous Democrats, I can't leave them. And we have such a good community of pro-life Democrats who want to move the party back to what it should stand for. And so that's what keeps me going. That's what keeps me here, is we need to keep this mission going. Because if we leave, what does it become if nobody's fighting back within the party against this terrible position?
But isn't the case of former Congressman Dan Lipinski kind of a cautionary tale here? Because one of the most successful, 16 years in Congress, you know, PhD from Duke and master's from Stanford in engineering, very smart, very hardworking man, respected on both sides of the aisle, and his own party plotted to destroy him over one issue, and that issue was abortion. So why would anybody like the person in Pennsylvania you're talking about see what they did? His own party, his own colleagues, they would rather have a pro-abortion Republican, I think, than have a pro-life Democrat in those offices.
In some senses, yes, I agree with you that, yes, there are Democrats who would rather see a pro-abortion Republican in office rather than, because this issue is such, they put it above everything else.
Right.
But I think the reason they put it above everything else is because it's a great fundraiser. They don't care about women. They care about power. And I think for the good of the future of our country, we can't stop the fight. And if we just cede within the Democratic Party and no one's fighting back there, it's going to get worse.
Right.
It's bad right now, but it will get worse, because then you will have people like a Trinae McGee run. And we have a candidate in Ohio who's running for state Senate. she would not be running as a pro-life Democrat if we weren't there to back her up and support her. So we need to support these courageous candidates who are willing to step up there. Right. And I wish there was more we could have done for Dan Lipinski to help him. He was a hero. He's a hero to me and to pro-life Democrats all around the country. And it was just a real disservice to our nation to go after these people who support the most vulnerable in our society,
right?
The mothers and the babies they're carrying.
So Ryan Burge is a statistician who understands religious trends in terms of voting like very few other people do. And he said, the white Catholic vote may be one of the most consequential voting blocks in the modern political landscape. And he noted that in 1972, two-thirds of white Catholics were Democrats. But by 2008, only 37% of white Catholics were Democrats. Today, it's about 36%, so it's dropped even another point. Why are Democrats losing this once completely reliable constituency?
They've been some of the extreme positions they've been taking, particularly on abortion. Like the parental rights is concerning to Catholic families as well. Teaching sex education earlier to, in elementary school.
Right.
I think those things are having a factor.
Sure. And transing children before, without parental knowledge, much less consent. I think, parental involvement laws and parental prerogatives I do think are dry, but that's interesting that you should point that out. Do you think the current immigration mess is going to move even more white Democrats over to the Republican Party? I live in Chicago, and I know you're out on the East Coast, but in Chicago alone, we've seen more than 30,000 illegally entered Venezuelan migrants here, and it is simply crushing the social service capacity that we have in the city. And it's been very interesting to me to see normally very strong Democratic constituencies, like, lifelong Black Chicagoans, saying they're going to vote Republican in the next election. What are you seeing with that dynamic? I find that so interesting.
We're not having a great, I'm outside DC, we're not seeing a big impact of immigration here. But I know in cities like Chicago and Colorado and New York, there was a story out about how these high school kids are now doing online learning because they had to move the immigrants into the school for safety because of the weather. So I am sure that will have a big impact on this election when school children are being displaced and going back to online learning, which was proved to be a failure.
Oh, terrible. Just so awful for children's mental health, and particularly, teenage mental health, really, really destructive to them. And, we're seeing that, in Chicago, Black communities that really rely on the park districts for everything from senior programs to preschool programs and after school programs for sports, they've all been displaced because it's winter in Chicago and the migrants have to go somewhere and we can't leave them on the street because, right, they're human beings. And we have to care at least for their basic needs. But I just see this, I don't see the problem getting any better. And I'm worried it's going to come to another kind of like flashpoint.
I agree with you on that. There's no organizational plan to try to help people who are coming into this country. They're just allowing them to come over, and then Catholic Charities can get a hold of some of them and help some, but there's no order to it.
Right.
So it's a real, the Biden administration should be doing a lot more to help these, instead of passing the blame game. It's the Republicans in Congress's fault.
Governor Abbott's fault. It's that evil Governor Abbott. This is all he is to blame for all of this. So I know that you're much more familiar with these stats because you move in this world, but we often hear that as many as 40% of Democrats, give or take, depending on the poll, roughly identify themselves as pro-life. But do you think that what's the disconnect then? If 40% of Democrats self-identify as pro-life, do they just not consider it a priority? Or, we used to at least, I think the real turning point here for me, just at the age that I am, is when Governor Robert Casey of Pennsylvania, the most populous Democratic state in the country, was not given a speaking slot at the Democratic convention the last time it was in Chicago. So 92, I think, right? Am I right? Yeah. And that seemed to be a big turning point for me. But, you know, even Bill Clinton came up with that calculation of safe, legal, and rare as sort of his talking points on abortion. But now it seems to me the party doesn't even try to reach out to pro-life Democrats. It doesn't even try to cater to them.
I think we did make some inroads during Obama's first term. But the second term of Obama, I think that was the major breakdown.
And was that because of the contraception mandate?
Yeah, it was after Obamacare and the, we had 65 Democrats vote against taxpayer funding of abortion led by Bart Stupak. But the vitriol after that and just the going after the Democratic Party, going after the only pro-life Democrat woman in Congress, Kathy Del Kemper, and not protecting her, that was just a wrong decision by the party, but they just dug their heels in after that, and there was no turning back. I think Hillary Clinton lost partially because of this issue. Mm. There were a lot of pro-life Democrats who would not vote for her.
Well, she wasn't a likable candidate anyway, but I do think that if you're even moderately concerned about this issue, is it like with the teachers union, they bring political muscle, or is it like Planned Parenthood just brings so much money because the abortion industry is just so incredibly lucrative, they're able to, pay for candidates who will do what they want. Do you think, what role does campaign finance have in this?
It's huge amounts of money. We have a Democrat from Pennsylvania, Brendan Boyle. He's huge disappointment to me. I feel personally just betrayed by him. He used to be a member of Democrats for Life when he was in the state house in Pennsylvania. He was pro-life. He used to come to all of our events. And the instant he ran for Congress, he flipped. And it's because of the promise of all the money. And the fundraising that they will provide. You come out as a strong pro-abortion candidate, Planned Parenthood will raise you a ton of money.
Yeah.
And the pro-life side, someone asked me one time, why doesn't the pro-life side, why don't they put all the money into the races? And my answer was, we're putting all our money toward pregnancy support.
Yeah.
I think most of the pro-life people are actually, giving money to their pregnancy centers and showing compassion and helping people in their neighborhoods and their communities. And I think a majority of our money goes there.
Right.
And we need to, to back our candidates more. And try to, counter this massive fundraising apparatus that controls the Democratic Party right now.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point, because I'm just kind of reflecting on, like my own family's charitable giving, and, we will move heaven and earth to support the pregnancy center and maternity home where I volunteer, because you meet the women, you see the children, they're real people in front of you that need help. And then, I've, donated to campaigns here and there, but I don't see that as a priority. Mm-hmm. Over a pregnant woman who's standing in front of me. And does that kind of mindset need to change, or do we?
No, I think absolutely not. I think we do need to focus on campaigns, but helping the compassion and the support for the women and their babies on the ground and in our neighborhoods and in our communities, our priorities are right on that. In fact, I went over to drop diapers off right around Christmas time. I bought a Costco box of diapers. And dropped it off. And I was talking to the pregnancy center and, one thing that's overlooked is these centers are compassionate toward women, no matter what their choice is.
Right. Even if they're not abortion minded, they're still going to give them help. Right.
They were telling me a story of a woman who was 22 weeks pregnant and she came for an ultrasound. She ended up getting the abortion, but the pregnancy center called her to see how she was doing. There was follow-up and compassion, and the woman was actually in the recovery room all alone, terrified.
Yeah.
And so the pregnancy center, talked her through and had more follow-up, but they're after the abortion.
Right.
And so these centers are just so critical to this movement. And I think we have to keep funding them. We have to keep, fighting for pregnancy centers and the pro-life community. We have our priorities right on that.
Right. Well, you know, that's something Catherine Jean Lopez, the writer at National Review, always says, is that they are our pro-life credibility, are the centers, right? That we walk the walk.
You know, one of the reasons why you say why pro-life Democrats continue to vote Democrat is because, you know, we say we're pro-life for the whole life.
Right.
And one of the issues is the child tax credit. You know, but the pro-life community can show our support for things like that, too. And I just signed a letter with a bunch of pro-life leaders in support of that. And I think the pro-life Democrats are obviously support things like that. But there's a lot of Democrats who will support those things, but then also support, you know, the candidate, even though they are a strong pro-abortion candidate, too, because they feel like some of these issues will help reduce abortion. But unfortunately, that's not the case. What women need is, I'm going to circle back to the pregnancy centers, is they need someone that will walk with them and support them. And, you know, because a lot of women are coerced into abortion, and these centers will counter that and help women make a real choice, have a real opportunity and choice to carry that pregnancy to term.
Right. I often in my talks cite Frederica Matthews Green. Green's book, Real Choices, where she went and she surveyed post-abortive women, I want to say in 10 major cities throughout the country, and just asked them, like, what were the things you didn't have that if you'd had them, you would have made a different choice? And the number one thing women said was, I didn't have anybody to walk with me. I had nobody to support me. The baby's father didn't want the baby, or my parents didn't want me to have the baby. She didn't have one person. And that, you know, that's something Mother Teresa talks about, that, you know, we have a great richness in material things, but we have a great poverty of love. Well, let me just, I just want to go back to a little bit of the political calculation. So sometimes the only way we have to meaningfully change a conversation in a political party is during a presidential campaign, because that seems to be when most people are paying attention. So with George W. Bush and John McCain, the GOP was pro-amnesty, or what they called, you know, pro-path to citizenship. And then that changed because when President Trump ran, he changed the voters' opinions, you know, largely through his rhetoric and the build the wall kind of, comments he was making. But he also moved voters on trade issues. So should pro-life Democrats consider running a presidential candidate who will bring up this issue, even if they know they're not going to win and they're not really viable, but in the same way like Vivek Ramaswamy is doing right now, sort of being the gadfly in the conversation and bringing up things like, you know, the January 6th FBI involvement, for example?
We were trying to convince John Bel Edwards to run because we thought he could be the voice to bring up some of these issues.
Right. And you wrote an op-ed about that. Can you just unpack that a little bit?
Yeah. So John Bel Edwards, he was the governor. His second term just ended, and he won governor twice in a red state. One of his first things that he signed when he became governor was Medicaid expansion to make sure that women get support. He focused on foster care. He was just this real whole life candidate, worked with the Republican legislature to accomplish a lot of good things. He was the only Democratic governor in the South and stood firm on his pro-life position. And that's the reason he was elected, because they tried to attack on it. And he put out an ad basically saying that the doctors told him and his wife to abort their first child and they didn't listen. She's now graduated college. But So we were trying to convince him to run because we thought he would be a good one to counter some of the issues on the national party that pro-life Democrats have concern about. Unfortunately, he finished out his term as governor. So we don't, maybe 4 years from now, we can get someone like him to run.
Was he term limited, or did he just decide personally not to run again?
It's term limited. It was two terms. But now we have no Democratic governors in the South.
That's astounding.
Right, because you have to be pro-life to win in the
right.
South.
Right, no, I would think so, in the South in particular. Well, so just to go back to the Catholic piece of it, in June of last year, so in June of 2023, about two dozen Catholic Democrat House lawmakers signed what they called a statement of principles advocating for legal abortion access and cited the tenets of their Catholic faith as their rationale for doing so. And the U.S. Bishops Conference pushed back, as they should have, and then other Catholics in prominent positions pushed back, and, you know, trying to explain to these guided Democrats that their position was contrary to church teaching. I mean, longstanding, you know, as John Paul II said, unchanged, unchangeable teaching on human life. And so you had said voters would find themselves, or sorry, the Congress people would find themselves hard pressed to find any reference or tenet that would justify killing conscience protections or justify support for taxpayer funding for abortions. Talk a little bit more about, I mean, we know just of course on its face what's problematic about that whole statement. How did you feel about it personally when you first saw it? And then do you feel like your response made any headway in terms of how this issue was reported or even how those particular lawmakers were thinking and what their staff was saying?
Yeah, no, it's so disappointing to see, you know, we see this over and over again where people try to justify their position on abortion with their Catholic faith. And, you know, they'll even say, well, I personally don't think that, don't support abortion, but I'm not going to, I can't put my personal position on my political
right
view. And I think that's just such a cop out. You know, what other issue would you do that for? You know, I don't support human trafficking, but I'm not going to, I'm going to still vote for it because I shouldn't use my personal position. My
right. And I can't impose my
personal views. Yeah. So I, yeah, to try to push their, use their Catholic faith to push abortion, it's a little bit disgusting and disappointing to see these members do this. And they do it time and time again. This isn't the first time they've tried to justify their position within their faith. You know, if they're going to vote for abortion, don't use your faith.
Please just, you know, find some other rationale. And, you know, the whole, it's just so tiresome. And, but you have a very, I don't know, either uninterested or uneducated electorate who doesn't seem to be interested in kind of delving in deeper and saying, well, what do you mean by that? Where in scripture does it say that abortion's okay? Right. I mean, it just, it's just very discouraging as just a Catholic and a woman, to see this right. sort of stuff, but, and just see, and you know what, I, unless they are just very misled people, they know they're lying. They know they're doing this, you know, deliberately.
They're in this echo chamber where they don't hear outside their position. You know, I have these conversations all the time. And it's amazing to me when you ask these questions, they can't answer them, or they become confused and, or no, that's not true. But every time I go vote here in Northern Virginia, I always go to the, and speak to the Democrats about abortion. And, nine times out of 10, I'll have a good conversation, but every once in a while, you know, it'll be, no, you're lying. You know, there are no late term abortions or no, they're just in this echo chamber where they just believe the rhetoric and they don't actually listen to what is happening. Mm-hmm. You know, cause there was a case recently in Ohio. It's a horrific case. This poor woman, she is now being, charged with, under the statute, treatment of a corpse, I think in Ohio. And she was 22 weeks pregnant, I believe, went to the hospital. The baby was not viable. The hospital said you should deliver the baby because she was bleeding.
Yeah.
She discharged herself and went home.
Okay.
And went back to the hospital two more times. And they said, you know, you really should deliver the baby. We should treat it. And she didn't. She went home. Delivered the baby and tried to flush the baby down the toilet.
Yeah.
And then she went back to the hospital because she was having major problems. And so they went to find, they're like, where's the baby? And it was just, I mean, the whole thing is horrific, but I think like going back to pregnancy centers, or like she should have been referred to a perinatal hospice or a pregnancy center. So someone could, she was all alone. And yeah. I think this is such a tragic case. Of course, it was politicized.
I did see the prosecutor in Ohio saying this has nothing to do with abortion. This is upholding statutes that have important public policy ends and are important teaching moments, that you don't take a human corpse and put it in a toilet. You know, it's right. But tragic on every level. But that woman should have been accompanied And
yeah, she should have got the support. And I mean, I just think how different this outcome would have been if she would have been put in touch with perinatal hospice,
right,
or she would have been in touch with somebody at a pregnancy center who could have talked her through, like, okay, so you delivered the baby at the home. This is the steps you can take. You
right.
know, somebody could
right.
have been there with her.
It's the sad thing about this world we live in now is that it does often leave women isolated and mm-hmm. Not knowing what to do in these kind of situations. But I want to go to something that you did, you know, speaking of this entire situation in Colorado. So Colorado's seen a 19% rise in the number of abortions, despite Dobbs in the last 2 years. And you at Democrats for Life presented a really interesting strategy for helping pregnant women. And tell me a little bit about how you did that and how you kind of took the woke language and kind of did a little jiu-jitsu there and turned it against the other side.
Yeah. So, you know, there's been this big push in Colorado to really, you know, fund abortion and focus on abortion. And we've done this in other states where, you know, we're talking about equity for pregnancy outcomes.
Right.
And when you are only pushing one pregnancy outcome, there's no equity in that. So,
yes.
So we need to have support for a mother who makes another choice. And so we've been pushing for maternity care, prenatal and postnatal care for free.
Which I just love. Birth should be
yes.
free.
Yeah.
Having done post-abortive counseling for many years as the director of our Archdiocese and Project Rachel office, so many of the women who I would be speaking with would say to me, and this always just broke my heart, I knew that I had other options. I knew that I could go to Catholic Charities or to the Pregnancy Center to Aid for Women and get help. I knew those things were out there, but I just couldn't do this. So they were choosing abortion, not because they were financially in peril or financially struggling. And some of them were, they were poor, but that wasn't the primary motivating factor. It was what Frederica Matthews Green uncovered in her book. It was the not having anybody who said, I could do it and I'll go with you. So how do you feel like, I mean, and I'm not in any way disparaging your efforts to make birth free. I think it should be. I think it is a natural, you know, healthy response of a female body to become pregnant, you know, and we should be accommodating those things in the public square, right? Which is what like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony were saying years and years ago. But I have no problem with that. But I wonder what your thoughts are that at the end of the day, even if it was free, do you think it'll really have that much of an impact? Will that gain traction in terms of the abortion numbers overall?
I think it will. When people look at the cost of birth versus the cost of an abortion, you know, there's a big, that
yeah,
is
it's significant. Yeah.
It's significant, you know, if you're uninsured or even if you have insurance with the copays. And I think JD Vance, who took our proposal, and is running with it in the US Senate, you know, he even experienced when his wife gave birth, like all these extra bills came in that
right.
were surprising that, you know, obviously he could afford, he's a successful author,
right.
but you know, I think for regular people who are living on fixed income, you know, the cost of birth can be a little daunting.
Mm-hmm.
And, and when you look at places like New York, who they'll even pay for your abortion. And, so that I think the interesting thing about New York as we're looking at is, their constitutional amendment that they're pushing, we would make it a constitutional right to have the baby. And we're looking at, well, what does that mean?
Yeah.
You know, does it mean that New York is now going to provide some equity as far as you pay for all of the abortion? So does that mean you'll have to pay for the birth and all
right.
the medical association and the right to have a baby?
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting thing to look at going forward.
Yeah, that's definitely something to watch and to see sort of what the, you know, the public reaction to that is as
mm-hmm.
well, and to see what some of the women's groups there do. But we've been talking a little bit about pregnancy centers and how important they are. So since Dobbs, since the draft was leaked, we have seen pregnancy centers being attacked both in terms of rhetoric from our elected officials, but also actual physical vandalism and arson and other really horrible things. And Catholic Vote's been tracking these attacks against pregnancy centers. And listeners, you can see the map of where those have taken place in the show notes below. But on October 16th of last year in 2023, the Democratic State Attorneys General signed a letter that falsely claimed that pro-life pregnancy centers are misleading consumers and delaying access to critical, time-sensitive reproductive health care. Okay, completely bogus, not true. Have you been working on within, you know, that the sort of the Democratic Attorney General's roles there, trying to help them to better understand what pregnancy centers done? And I can guarantee not one of those people who signed that letter has ever set foot inside a pregnancy center.
No, that's one of our missions for this year. We're working on a legal response to the attorneys general, but we are we have already wrote a 5-page response to Congressman Josh Gottheimer from New Jersey, who stood in front of the Lighthouse Pregnancy Center disparaging it with the same lies the attorney general's told. And he has never stepped foot in the center. So we hand-delivered a letter to him, gave it right to him. So he has it. He read it. We invited him to visit the center with us. We have sent 4 follow-up requests for him to come visit the center, and he has refused to even respond. So we are going down there on the Hill. We'll be on the Hill during the March for Life, and we're going to stop by his office and ask him why he's unwilling to go learn the truth about the pregnancy centers.
Right.
And stop lying, because he is flat out lying about what they do.
I mean, even if he would just, if he won't go in the center, meet with a couple of the clients, meet with women who have been assisted by pregnancy centers so they can tell their, share their own stories. I mean, you know, everybody, we, all of us, we can share of women we know and clients that we, they're wonderful success stories. I could go on and on just from the one pregnancy center where I volunteer, and I know that's multiplied nationwide. And if they would just give us a fair chance to tell our stories and to let these women tell their own stories, I think you would really move the needle on this issue.
Yeah, it's so consistent with traditional democratic values to support the vulnerable. Like, we don't shut down food pantries. We don't shut down housing facilities. This is in the same vein as that kind of outreach, you know? And so why do we carve out this very negative anti-woman position for pregnant women?
Right.
It just makes no sense. And, you know, I think another challenge we have as pro-lifers as a whole is the reporters who are unwilling to learn the truth about the centers. Because there was actually an article in one of the New Jersey papers yesterday about the same pregnancy center. And I wrote her and I invited her to come visit the center.
Good
and I gave
you.
Her a copy of our letter from that we sent to Congressman Gottheimer. And she didn't immediately say she would go, but she said she would consider it. So those are the kind of things we need to do, is we need to start inviting reporters, our legislators, and showing them that the truth about the centers.
Right. And there was a really remarkably fair story. This was right after Dobbs, I think, that came out on CBS News. And Jan Crawford, who's their one of their kind of Supreme Court reporters, went to Mary's Shelter, which I think is also in Virginia. Am I right about that? And visited, and, you know, they gave her a tour. She met two of the women who were living there. And then just sort of miraculously, while they were there filming, a woman in a U-Haul pulled up who had driven there from Florida because she had nowhere else to go and she was pregnant. And right then and there, they took her in. But, you know, one of the two women they, you know, she was interviewing was, she worked at a fast food restaurant and she slept behind a dumpster at the restaurant at night pregnant. And she was just kind of telling her story, and you could just see how moved Jan Crawford was and how just the pregnancy center director, and no one was trying to, you know, pull the wool over anybody's eyes. They had complete access to the home, to the centers, the rooms where the women lived with their children. And you could see how just from the beginning of the story to the end, how much her, you know, her facial expressions changed and how positive this end report was. And so, you know, at the, after she had, you know, said, and this is Jan Crawford for CBS News, the young man who was the newsreader that day said, well, but it does all come down to a woman's choice, doesn't it? And that was, I mean, you just, after this beautiful display of human kindness and compassion and generosity, you know, the it was too much for the anchor to handle, and he had to bring it right back to, well, it's just, they chose that, you know?
That's choice. And by shutting down these centers, you're taking away choice.
Yes. Yeah. And again, I don't know of any center that works to deceive women. No, certainly none that I've ever encountered in my 30 years as a pro-life activist.
You know, who does deceive is the Planned Parenthood clinics, because they do not provide prenatal care or postnatal care.
Right. I think there might be like eight two. Of all there's
no.
two. Is it two?
It's, no, I don't, it's, I don't, know. It's I don't like, know. I haven't.
Was it Live Action? Did the undercover investigation where they called hundreds of Planned Parenthood centers nationwide and just said, I'd like to come in for my prenatal care appointment. And there was one very awkward conversation where the Planned Parenthood clinic director saying, well, we don't do that. We do the opposite. And she's like, oh, but you know, it says here, like you have prenatal care. Right. And in one case, I mean, I guess to their credit, they said, you know, no, there's a pregnancy center though, four doors down, and they do prenatal care there. You can go there. So to their credit, they did at least send this one particular caller to the right place. But, you know, very interesting. Yeah. So, we're, as you said, whole life, pro-life for the whole life. How do you feel the Democratic Party is doing on some of those other issues, like assisted suicide, which now, what are we calling now? What's the new euphemism? Medically assisted death or something like that?
Or not doing well on that issue. Interesting. So I was in Maryland. Maryland's really pushing the assisted suicide right now. And we were there on a pro-life issue was going to testify. And it happened to be the same day that the assisted suicide people were there.
Okay.
And so I talked to people. So I went up and I asked them, I said, well, why are you supporting? I said, I have some concerns about assisted suicide because the people that it's going to harm are the people who don't have money or don't have health insurance.
Or who have disabilities.
Vulnerable, who have disabilities. Mm-hmm. And I said, as a Democrat, I can't support that. And he fumbled a little bit because I feel like these people don't think about the issue wholly. They just...
No, they listen to talking points and, you know...
Talking points and then go, this is so good. Like people can take their own lives. You don't think about who is going to be affected.
Yeah. Dr. Mary Keene-Kirchhoff, we've done an Edify episode with her. She's a neurodevelopmental pediatrician and she primarily treats children with disabilities, almost exclusively severe disabilities. And she said to me, my patients and their families are terrified of these laws, terrified of them, because once Medicaid runs out for a disabled child, once whatever kind of additional programming they might be entitled to as a person with a disability, they're first in line when, you know, we can look at now this medically assisted death, if that's something you'd like to consider. And some of the older, you know, kids, they're terrified of becoming burdens on their parents. They see their parents struggling already to care for them. It is heartbreaking. You would think that this would be such a significant part of the Democratic ethos, right? That no, you can't take a vulnerable person with a disability and make them feel like they're better off dead.
I saw a speech with Sister Dee Dee.
Sister Dee Dee Byrne, sure. Who was a Catholic religious sister who was also a medical doctor, for those listeners who might not
remember. And she's amazing. But one of the sisters was in, I think it was in Missouri, and they actually, Sister Dee Dee wanted to bring her home to D.C. and care for her. She's a doctor.
Right.
And the sister wanted to come too and just be with Christ, you know, be with the Eucharist, have communion. And the medical facility refused to move her and pulled her fooding tube and killed her. And they said that she wanted to go and she clearly did not. They have an interview with her saying, I mean, she was very, very sick. But
there was someone who was a doctor who was willing to take care of her personally
and to not move her. And is that the direction we're going, where just if one doctor feels like they should end the life, then they can push it in that direction for someone who's vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
It's a scary direction that we're going. On the death penalty, I feel like we're making some good progress on the death penalty.
I was just going to ask you that. Yeah.
Yes. And our Ohio chapter is taking the lead there and trying to get stop the death penalty in Ohio. We're really proud of our Ohio people.
Well, let's talk. You mentioned during the course of this terrific conversation, Kristen, some of the pro-life Democrats that you work with. But who, in your opinion, at both a federal, if any, and state level, are the strongest pro-life Democratic voices today?
Katrina Jackson, for sure, in Louisiana. We have Trine McGee up in Connecticut. She's a young Black woman, 26 or 27, who, when she was elected, one of her first speeches was on pro-life. And
excellent.
She turned 17 votes in the Democratic caucus to vote against abortion, just with her advocacy and speaking out. Jeff Turco up in Massachusetts, who I love, he voted against forcing health insurance companies to pay for abortion. And one of his constituents was mad at him, and he said, "I'd rather lose my reelection than to vote against protecting the vulnerable." So we have some really good legislators around the country. Joe Manchin will be gone. He's not running again. So we don't have an advocate in the Senate anymore.
What do you think about Robert Kennedy Jr., his campaign as an independent? Do you think he's someone that could be moved by pro-life Democrats?
I think he could. We have not reached out to him, but I do think that he... as an independent, he's obviously independent.
Yes, very
literally
much so.
Right now. Mm-hmm. But I think he could be moved on that front.
Well, there's some reason that the party's not supporting him, which I find very strange. And I wonder if maybe he has a more nuanced position on abortion, and that's what they don't like. And so
they didn't want Joe Biden to have to debate anybody.
Yeah,
I mean, I wonder if he's going to debate. If Trump is the nominee, if he'll find some way out of debating him, because I don't know how, if he has the ability to do that. And so they just wanted to clear the field. So there's nobody running
against.
So that's it.
So it's more of a, like, if President Biden has to debate somebody in a primary, then that'll expose his deficiencies. Well, this is my last question to you, and I hate to put you on the spot, but as executive director of Democrats for Life of America, what are your hopes and your predictions for the 2024 election cycle?
Oh, my hopes. I hope that our pro-life Democrat candidates win. We have several good ones running. So that is my hope.
What are the races you're looking at? What is specifically?
So we have a candidate up in New Jersey. Reverend Green is going to run up in New Jersey. We have Jill Hall, who's running in Ohio. And we have this new candidate who's possibly running in Pennsylvania. We have a lot of incumbents as well, but we hope that Henry Cuellar maintains his seat because while he doesn't vote 100% with us, he has a nuanced position on abortion and he votes. He's there when we need him. My prediction is I think Trump's going to be the nominee and win.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with you.
I do. Unless they pull Biden out at the last minute and put somebody in. I wouldn't be surprised if they put Newsom in, and he's a slick salesman,
but not a very likable candidate. I don't think he did well at all when he debated DeSantis. I thought that didn't go particularly.
You didn't, but I think he can. I think he's good looking. He's persuadable. Mm-hmm. People will get on board with him and just vote.
Yeah,
I think so. I mean, I don't know. I haven't seen the polls on Newsom versus Trump. I don't see Biden going the long haul. Maybe I could be wrong, but I think when you look at the Democratic process, the Democratic Party has to be careful about walking the walk. If they want to protect the Democratic process, they have to truly protect it. And they're not showing that they're doing that with, not allowing the primary debates, pulling New Hampshire away from, like, not counting them. As the process going on with delegates, because they wouldn't adhere to what the party wanted. And they wanted them to basically avoid their constitutional mandate, and then getting rid of the Iowa caucuses, longstanding. So I just think the Democratic Party has to be a little careful about what they're...
They got away with it during COVID. And I think too, you know, there was sort of a little bit of backlash against President Trump, but now, you know, people, everything from the prices at the grocery store to the prices at the gas pump, to national security and immigration, I think, you know, people vote with their pocketbooks and in their own personal best interests at the end of the day. And I do think they can't keep the wool over people's eyes about how compromised mentally but Biden is. And it's not his fault. I mean, he's an elderly gentleman, but he's, God love him, he's not all there.
I don't know. If I were his family, I would say, maybe you should consider. We should have passed the torch.
We'll see what happens. But I know I join my hopes to yours that it will be a strong year for people who will protect human life and who will also support pregnant women.
Yes, that's the direction we need to go as a party and as a country.
I agree. Well, we'll end it on that very hopeful note. Kristen Day, Executive Director of Democrats for Life of America. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you for listening. To make it easier for you to listen to future Edify podcast episodes, please make sure you subscribe over at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Thank you.